Please, I am here with Eduardo Porter, who is most recently the author of The Price of Everything. Eduardo, how are you doing?
I'm well. How are you? Thanks for having
me. I'm doing all right. I wanted to go ahead and start this conversation on a question of faith, which seems rather apropos to the question of prices. In your chapter, The Price of Faith, you point out the Pascalian wagers of faith omits the idea that believing only to claim a future reward would likely be construed as corrupt, and that God might not be too pleased by this. Can you not say the same thing about the free market, except there is no God, and the God of commerce is going to be completely hot to trot over this idea? What makes our faith in fair prices any different from religious faith?
Our faith in fair prices is a strange way to put it. I'm not sure that we have a faith in fair prices.
Oh?
I'm not sure that I would construe prices as being fair. Prices are a variable that denotes the value of something as realized in a transaction.
Yes.
But there's nothing inherently fair about that. The seller of this object, this commodity in this transaction, is out to get the most he or she can get for it.
Yeah.
The buyer presumably is trying to get this commodity for the least he or she can pay for it. And if there is a deal to be made, if there is a point where the object is worth sufficient to the buyer that he will pay or she will pay enough to the seller, that's its price. But there, I don't think there was anything fair in here. Yeah. You know, the notion of justice isn't really present in this transaction.
Yeah. I think the perception of it being fair, much like the religious faith that God is fair, when in fact we all know that if you believe in God, he may or may not be fair.
Well, in fact, the notion of price is imbued in religious thought.
Yeah.
When, you know, the first thinkers started thinking about what prices were and what they meant back in the times of the Greeks, they did, in fact, relate it to a sense of justice. They had a sense that things had some real value that embodied something truthful about, you know, a commodity, an object, a thing that you bought in the market. And for hundreds of years, this notion of a just value, a real, true value that had to be reflected in the price was central to the analysis of prices. So essentially, this took the shape throughout the Middle Ages of a notion that prices embodied, the price of a thing embodied the work that had gone into making the thing.
Yeah.
And that idea survived well into the 17th century, where, you know, it took several forms and it kind of like reached its apogee with Karl Marx, who said, you know, the value of anything is basically the sum of all the labor that has gone into the thing, that went into the tools to make the thing, that went into the tools to make the tools to make the thing, you know, and so forth. And he argued that profit was the owners of the means of production, of land, of tools, of capital, basically paying workers less than this value and keeping, you know, the extra. This idea of price, however, ultimately had a problem in that it didn't quite take into account the interaction, the transaction. The, you know, a price needs somebody to want to buy something to exist. And so this idea that prices were kind of like inside the object did not quite understand the specific kind of human relation, human transaction that made prices be. And I think that ultimately, our understanding of prices as a function of a transaction, where there's, you know, a supplier and a demander of something, released price from this moral origin.
Yeah.
And turned it into a kind of like amoral fact. You know, a price is what you'll pay for, you know, this candy bar, and I'll pay $2. And if after paying $2, I run into a real true chocolate lover who's willing to pay me $3 for it, I might sell it to him for $3. And I don't think that the $2 were unfair or the $3 were unfair. They just were, and they were a manifestation of our different preferences for chocolate.
but someone was possibly exploited in the course of that $2, $3 candy bar. I mean, the point I'm trying to make here is that we have a faith that the price is fair. You know, you bring up Dan Ariely, and he has run numerous behavioral economics tests to indicate that our relation with price is extremely funny and based off of this idea of fairness. And so that's sort of why I bring up the question.
We do live, let me put it this way, fairness is a part of our idea set. We think about it all the time. We think about it when we transact things. But I think it is very context dependent. If we feel that we got a crummy cup of coffee and we paid $2, we'll think it's unfair. But it's not because coffee is not worth $2. It's because our expectations were at a certain level and the delivery, the reality happened to be different. And so this gap is what creates this sense of unfairness. So I would say that, yes, when you pay somebody very little, it will feel unfair. And in fact, that's probably why we tip in restaurants, because waiters don't make the minimum wage, and we sense that as not being fair, and so we decide to pay waiters an extra tip, basically because we're buying a sense of fairness.
Yeah.
You know, and also we're also buying a sense of our own goodness. If you go to Japan, I lived in Japan for a few years, and I remember I would tip regular, you know, when I first got there, and waiters would run after me out onto the street to give me back my money. Who's this crazy foreigner leaving money on the table? Because they don't tip in Japan, because the wage structure is different, right? And so tips are not part of the notion of fairness in that context, in that society.
Yeah, but you also point out in the epilogue of the book that you checked the price of your Los Angeles condo that you had sold many years ago. Is that really your particular property to keep track of? Is it really your business to be concerned about the potential augmentation of the deal that you made instead of the deal that you did make? Move on, pal. That's what I was saying.
I would agree with you. I mean, this is totally morbid, this interest, you know, in this house. I liked it a lot. You know, it brings back good memories. I've never lived nearer the ocean than I did in this property, so it had some iconic value to me. And the way that I kept track of it was every now and then going back and looking at how much people thought it cost. I mean, also because I knew that we were in this enormous housing bubble, and I was sort of like tracking it through this kind of like personal experience of mine, trying to see, well, what does a housing bubble look like, you know, from the perspective of my personal history.
Yeah.
But I mean, from the price of this particular property in Los Angeles and how it evolved, both after I bought it and certainly after I sold it, you know, like going up and down like a roller coaster, underscores not a point about the fairness of prices, but about their accuracy and what they ultimately represent. And to me, this notion, the evolution of the price of my house shows me that prices can totally go totally off the rails, can be totally unhinged, and at some point really represent nothing but sort of like dreams and odd expectations and irrational sort of like desires.
But clearly something to you after the fact.
Yeah, but I wasn't actually putting my real money there. It was just, you know, like looking at it, you know, kind of like, you know, peeking at it over the corner.
A less harmful version of online poker, I presume.
That's right, okay. And less costly.
Yeah. Speaking of bubbles, of financial bubbles, you write that virtually every potentially profitable new frontier opened up to investment has led to a speculative bubble. Virtually. Are there specific examples of new frontiers that you can cite in which there isn't a bubble? You bring up economist Robert C. Wright, who suggested that bubbles can be identified before they happen. Actually, you didn't bring that up. That's actually just out there. Robert C. Wright suggested that bubbles can be predicted. Seeing as how they've remained a regular economic surprise for at least three centuries, why then do companies and individuals allow themselves to be taken in with the latest offshoot of tulip mania? Is there something about pricing that causes that zeal? Or?
Well, there is a notion that if you stop, that even if you identify correctly a bubble, you can lose a lot of money by, you know, not playing in it,
yeah.
Right? And so this is actually what keeps bubbles alive for so long, because even if a substantial number of investors in a given market decide that market is overvalued, but they also know that there's an enormous number of other investors that will continue playing in this market and buying in this market, it will be very costly for them to exit. So if they're a fund manager that has clients, the clients will likely fire this fund manager. If this fund manager correctly identifies a bubble, exits the market, and the market goes up another 50% because there's another, you know, few thousand people who are nuts and keep buying this thing. And this has actually happened. This is not theoretical.
Sure.
So there is, it's not that everybody has to be irrational for a bubble to form. Lots of people can actually call it correctly, but still not, you know, still play it and still contribute to the inflation of the bubble.
Yeah.
I mean, this was identified way back with Keynes. Keynes points out that, you know, markets are like beauty contests where the point is not identifying, the point of the judges is not identifying the most beautiful contestant, but identifying the contestant which all the other participants consider the most beautiful. And in the market, that's what you're doing. You're trying to buy an asset on your based on your belief of what everybody else is doing. And if you believe that everybody else is buying, well, then you buy, and then everybody has the same thought, and
Pets,
everybody buys.
Pets.com is a beauty contest.
That's exactly right. And in these sorts of markets in where the ultimate real price is a function of the expectations of all the players in the market are prone to bubbles. There are markets that I would say are not prone to bubbles. And in those markets, the expectations of all the investors that play in them can actually give you a very accurate prediction of the price. And this is the example of Orange Juice and the Weather that was written up by some economists in the 1970s who found that investors in the orange juice market were better at predicting the weather in orange-producing regions than the weather service. And that's because there was a great number of orange juice buyers and traders, and, you know, each one had their little chunk of information, right? And each bought and sold on the basis of that little chunk of information on their hunches. And as you averaged out all these hunches, you know, where the extremes canceled each other out, right? The person who thought that cold weather was coming from Mars canceled out the person who thought that hot weather was coming from Venus, right? And so you ultimately got a very accurate perception of the weather. But that's because there is such an objective thing called the weather.
Yeah.
And there is not an objective thing called a stock price. It's outside the experience of the investors.
Yeah. So you're saying that more logical bubbles, such as the orange juice scenario, are going to be better reflected outside of market variables and more aligned with, say, a kind of ancillary variable, such as the weather, or what would be another example of this?
Well, what I'm saying is that the wisdom of crowds, investors can find the real price of something, or to put it perhaps more accurately, markets, as in the actions of individual investors, will give us probably the best price, the best estimate of the price of a given thing. If that given thing has an objective price outside the expectations of investors.
Yeah.
So, for instance, the probability of Barack Obama winning the presidential election, that he will win or lose independently of what the investors in the political betting market think.
Sort of a speculative derivative, if we're talking
about
that.
That's right. They can buy and sell within this market, but they will not determine the outcome.
Sure.
And in that scenario, they can give you a very, very precise estimate of the probability of a Barack Obama winning or losing.
Yes.
But if they are actually going to move the probabilities, if their actions change the probabilities themselves, then it's very, they could easily lead, this kind of behavior leads to bubbles. So because like everybody believes that houses are going to rise and therefore houses rise. Everybody believes that dot-com stocks will rise and dot-com stocks rise. It becomes a self-fulfilling dynamic.
Yet it's almost a sort of ongoing Sisyphean rock. I mean, now we're out of control almost. I mean, we've seen the too big to fail model. We've seen countless bubbles throughout history pop. We've seen constant inflation, constant artificial augmentation of these prices. So the question, I suppose, is how does one separate the legitimate bubbles from the bullshit bubbles?
You know, I don't know that one can.
Yep.
And here's the other problem. Say you identify a bubble. What do you do about it is not a trivial question. And I am, you know, I am sympathetic to the argument that even if you know a bubble is happening, you shouldn't necessarily try to prick it. Because this bubble is generating economic activity, is generating jobs, and you do not know the evolution of the curve of prices, how this bubble will evolve if you prick it or if you do not prick it.
Yeah.
What will that do to investment and employment and so on? In hindsight, it's clear to me that the housing bubble was a disaster and something should have been done about it way before. And also one must understand that pricking a bubble is not the only option one has. One can lean against a bubble, increasing interest rates or through other, financial regulations that make it more difficult for it to inflate. However, as just a matter of principle, the question of when to deflate a bubble is not an easy one to take. And so even though I think that Greenspan was utterly wrong in just letting this thing go.
Yeah. And that was a case where the interest rates in relation to the subprimes were out of proportion, and the bubble was probably one of the biggest bubbles we ever saw.
Oh, yes. I'm not entirely convinced that this was a question. This was due to low interest rates, or at least low short-term interest rates, low interest rates that are controlled by the Federal Reserve. It was clearly due to low interest rates on the long end of the yield curve. But I'm not sure how much traction the Fed had at the long end, and in fact at one point Greenspan complained that his actions by increasing interest rates in the short term were having no impact on the long term, and that's where you got arguments that were articulated by the current Fed chairman Ben Bernanke about how it was basically a flood of money coming in from developing countries that were saving a lot of money, and that was so no matter what the Fed was doing, there was this very pile of money moving into treasury bills and long-term securities that was keeping interest rates very, very low.
Yeah.
I mean, there are ways that the housing bubble could have been addressed through just not through monetary policy but through regulation, just stopping banks from offering crazy mortgage products to people who the banks knew couldn't afford to pay them. That would have done a great deal to avoid the more absurd end of the housing bubble. So it wasn't really a matter of the price of money. It was more of the matter of where regulators allowed this money to go.
Yes. While we're on the subject of creating additional jobs, I want to bring up the John Rawlsian idea, which is in the book, that societies need to maximize the well-being of the least fortunate. You write that no society has ever met this goal, but that most democratic governments redistribute income in some way from rich to the poor. Well, as we have seen, some have argued that the recent Obama tax compromise rewards higher income taxpayers at a rate disproportionate to the unemployment benefits. Behavioral economics, which we brought up briefly earlier, has demonstrated that people react to price based on their interpretive savings rather than their real savings. And then going back to this issue of jobs, well, even if you have jobs promoted through a bubble, those jobs may very well be ephemeral. They may go away in
about a year. In this case, they were.
Yes, of course, of course. And so the question is there any aspect of prices that you can cite that would buttress the Rawlsian idea of direct, non-interpretive assistance to the less fortunate?
I'm not sure I'm interpreting your question correctly, but
something that isn't so cutthroat, something that isn't so predicated upon, okay, we're democratic, but we're really hoarding the wealth. Is there any sort of price-like situation where that Rawlsian ideal is reflected in a democratic government?
Well, say, I mean, the United
Republican.
States is at one extreme of the distribution of redistribution amongst democratic industrial societies. We are perhaps the stingiest of democratic, rich democratic societies that I know of compared to, the rest of the OECD nations. So there is redistribution through taxation in the United States. But the size of the state, the size of the pie that is subject to being, reallocated by the government is much, much smaller. It's about 19 points of GDP. In many European countries, it's 10 percentage points of GDP bigger. I'm not sure that this is your question, but why that happens to be is to me a very interesting question. Why is the United States so different, has such a different attitude regarding redistribution than some of these other countries? And I find compelling, I'm not necessarily convinced, but I think that the one plausible hypothesis is that the United States is a much less homogeneous society. And heterogeneity, diversity, creates resistance to redistribution. So when you're a Swede and everybody around you is blonde and tall and Swedish, redistributing through the tax system will look like helping somebody that's more or less like yourself. In a much more diverse country, as is the United States, there tends to be a divide between, you know, so that creates a barrier between the contributor in the form of taxes and who this contributor believes the money is going to go to. And this issue was realized by Friedrich Engels, who thought that this kind of that diversity would make it very difficult to create a labor movement in the United States. William Julius Wilson recognized this, saying, you know, problem is whites see welfare as paying for something that they can't afford for blacks. So this barrier, to my mind, is what is probably a powerful reason that there is such little support for fiscal redistribution, for the idea of paying into the Commonwealth in the United States, and that it is lower than in other countries, other rich countries around the world.
Well, to pound the point of anti-egalitarianism home, I wanted to bring up a couple of things. Sir Nicholson Stern's idea of the absolute welfare of the individual remaining steady throughout the years, or St. Expurzy's idea of human life is priceless. This was put to the test, as you point out in the book, by the 9/11 Commission. Kenneth Feinberg, he adjusted economic loss based off of age, marital status, dependence. There were serious gaps in the awards. The 9/11 victims who had earned $4 million a year, they got $6.4 million. The ones who earned less, valued as at least as $250,000. This created the conflict of competing subjective viewpoints over, well, you know, this guy was going to be with me for the rest of my life, or, hey, he had three children and that guy had two. Huge mess. Is there any foolproof solution to such ruthless, cold accounting like this?
No, there is not. Yeah. None that I know of. I would argue that it does make sense. Let me put it differently. I am not troubled necessarily by the idea that society places a value, a finite value, on the lives of people, and that value happens to be low. I feel it's reasonable that I will value my own life at infinity, but others will not. And I understand that a healthcare system, say, has to decide if it's going to pay $100,000 to save another year of my life, $1 million to save a year of my life, $10 million. At some point, it's going to be reasonable for this society or this health insurance system to say, stop.
Yeah.
Above that, I won't go. And that stop moment puts an upper bound on the value of my life. So this is not unreasonable. What I find problematic, but I don't know the solution to, is the distributional impact of the way that we do it that you point out.
Yeah.
It's, you know, the system used by Feinberg, which, I mean, essentially he looks at how much you're going to contribute in economic output throughout your life, and that's what you're worth. That's essentially what he did. So if you're a stockbroker that's going to earn tons of money, you're worth a big chunk of money. If you're a janitor that earns $11 an hour, you're only going to be worth, well, much, much less. And ultimately, that was the essential framework that determined the payouts by the 9/11 fund for the relatives of the victims of the terrorist attacks. And Ken Feinberg, the guy who designed this, he was a very thoughtful man, and he'd worked with he worked for Ted Kennedy. He was very sensitive to these inequities, and in fact tried to reduce them as much as he could. In fact, had this been done mechanically by, you know, you earn this much, you're worth this much, the disparities would have been enormous. At the end of the day, the biggest reward was $6.4 million. The smallest was $250,000.
Yeah.
But these disparities could have been much, much larger. The reason, however, that it ended up being so unequal was that because the purpose of the fund was to get the victims of the attacks not to sue the airlines. And so they wanted to get as many people to participate in this fund as possible. If everybody started to opt out and decided to go their own way via the courts, there was this feeling that the whole American airline system would get, or United at the very least, American Airlines as well, maybe the Port Authority, I don't know, they'd get like sued out of existence. So they needed to pay these high-end people more in order to keep them in the system. That's not necessarily fair, but it was the purpose of the object. There are other ways of calculating the price of life, the way that governments, the way that the EPA right now calculates the value of an American, which incidentally it estimates at about $7.5 million, and the Department of Transportation has its own number, which is thereabouts a little lower, and the Department of Agriculture has its own. The way that these agencies do this is by looking at our behavior and looking at what kind of risks we are willing to take for what kind of prices. So to give you an example, if we will drive above the speed limit, which will save us X number of hours in commuting time, but will increase our chances of dying by Y percent, we can actually work out, you know, how many hours do we save per extra death.
Yeah.
And if at our average wage, we can tell you, well, how much are we valuing life? You know, how much are we valuing one death on the road?
Yes.
In fact, this was done by economists when the speed limit was increased in the 1980s from the 55 mile per hour federal speed limit to 65 mile per hour in several states. Some economists actually did this number crunching based on the behavior of drivers, and they came out with a number that drivers were valuing a life at $2.1 million. And so these are the techniques that are used most commonly today, but they're also really problematic because they don't take into account that people make choices not in enormous freedom. People's choices are always constrained by their situation. So, you know, if you're poor, you're constrained by your lack of money.
Yeah.
So you can't buy the super duper gadget that's going to protect your life if you ride on a bike. So you'll ride without a helmet because you can't pay for the $25.
Yeah.
But that doesn't really mean that you're willing to take that extra risk. It's because your choices are constrained in a different way than the choices of somebody who can pay whatever for a helmet, you know. And so they had these distributional issues, and this has come up as a problem before. In the mid-1990s, a study by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change tried to come up with an early estimate of the economic impact of global warming. And to do this, it used some of these estimates of the value of life, and it decided that the value of life in poor countries was $150,000 and in rich countries was $1.5 million.
Yeah.
Now, you can imagine that didn't go down very well at an international meeting with rich and poor countries. I mean, this was a rebellion. What do you mean? So, like, if rising seas are going to wipe out Bangladesh, it's cheap.
Yeah.
But if, you know, something's going to happen to Switzerland, then we really got to worry. So, ultimately, at the end of the day, they came to a political compromise, and everybody was just, you know, they redid this, valuing everybody at $1 million.
But on the other hand, for the sake of argument, if you had some central authority making such an insensitive statement that a person born in one country is worth less than a person born in an industrialized nation, wouldn't that open up the fact that we're all living within unseen disparities? That, you know, the value of someone who is toiling right now in the Maquiladora or an export processing zone is, we all know, worth less than the life of President Obama or the life of actor Clive Owen, who is probably worth more than either of us ever will be, you know?
Well, yes, this is a manifestation of the inequities in life.
Yeah.
That it's exactly, it's just a replication after death of a very unequal distribution of opportunities and rewards.
Yeah.
That's true.
Well, then, if pricing essentially confirms that, it's almost as if pricing is confirms an Ortega-Gasset-like notion of elitism, that that really what we're denying these crude and cold and insensitive price is denying the inherent elitist nature of the capitalist system that we live by in this purported democracy that you, in the book, actually uphold.
I would say that that's essentially correct. I mean, capitalism is not an equal society, and I don't think it can work as an equal society. Disparities are what steer resources to be allocated into one place or another. Pay differentials lead people to, you know, to take one choice rather than another, to move into one job or another, to get one type of education or another. So the idea that everybody must be paid equal is, I don't think, functional. It does not function within a capitalist society. If you're asking for my opinion on the ultimate, I don't want to use the word justice. If you're asking for my opinion on whether this is an ideal way to live, I would tell you no. But it's because of the depth of the disparity, not because of its existence.
Yeah.
I will agree that disparities will exist. I have a problem with the size of them.
You mentioned Bangladesh earlier, and this is in relation to climate change. William Nordhaus's idea that in estimating future damages, we need to use a rate that reflects the productivity of long-term investments. And of course, you've got Sir Nicholas Stern's idea, the welfare of a person hundreds of years from now is worth the same as the welfare of someone alive today. And of course, not everybody can agree on that either, which is that now we're adding time to this, even more problems. You know, you also, if you were to look at the history of Haiti, you see France in 1825, they don't wish to recognize Haiti's sovereignty unless Haiti paid them 150 million gold francs. Haiti, of course, couldn't pay back the money until 1947, and they had to take up long-term interest loans.
That's
which
incredible.
Which is the ultimate in a big joke about price. I mean, Haiti wanted to be recognized as the ultimate, you know, as a nation, and they have to pay this considerable amount of money for this. So this leads me to wonder if, you know, price, I seem to think, particularly after this conversation, is a huge mess that creates ever more problems about other viewpoints, other peoples, and just simple existing. I mean, the more we think about the way money is attached to an individual person, the more we realize that certain systematic norms cause the person to be trivial. I think that's rather sad.
The thing is, here we're moving between senses of price that are really kind of unrelated. The purchase of Haiti's independence, I think, has probably very little to do with capitalism. It has more to do with colonialism, right?
Oh, also, capitalism, Texas. Could be argued as
well,
a
but no, but yeah. This deal could have been made outside a capitalistic society. This deal is not a function of capitalism. It is a function of the fact that one country controlled another and would not relinquish it unless getting something in return. And in fact, this has been a characteristic of colonialism way back into pre-capitalistic times. I wonder whether you're not attributing too much significance to the idea of price as an ultimate driver of things that functions throughout history in always in the same way. It seems to me that when you're talking about the price of Haiti or the price of gas or the price of milk, the processes that you're describing, that with which you arrive at this ultimate variable of price, are totally different, and the transactions that are involved are entirely different. And so, yes, they're all prices, of course. But I'm not sure that they're comparable. They seem a little bit like apples to oranges.
Even though price has a serious consequence upon a human life in some capacity, that you're saying that it's best to look at price in terms of who sets the price and the consequences. I think I'm looking at it consequentially, and you're looking at it from a causist standpoint.
Well, yeah, but kind of like consequentially, let's say clothes have enormous consequences. Lack of clothes has enormous consequence. what, and the fact that, that, you know, the having or not having the appropriate clothes for the appropriate weather is consequential.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that that allows me to go any further and to tell me anything about the dynamic underlying clothes or the goodness of clothes or the, you know, they're consequential, sure.
Yeah. Eduardo, thanks so much. It was a pleasure. No,
well, thank you. I mean, it's great. And trips to the